You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at wicn.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is The Public Eye. Nice to have you with us. Perhaps people in my age bracket, and there's nothing wrong with being a little older, a little wiser, right? But I remember names such as Corona, Royal, Olivetti. What is it all about? Well, those were typewriter brands, very popular, very common typewriter brands. Now, for younger generation, people be scratching their head and wondering, what is a typewriter? Well, for decades, journalists especially use typewriters to put their stories together for newspapers, for magazines, even authors and writing books. And that's why I've asked my guest this week, author Lance Morrow, to join me because his new book, The Noise of Typewriters, Remembering How Journalism Once Was, chronicles how some of the great stories, the great journalists of the past actually, banged out stories on typewriters. Today would seem almost unheard of to do any kind of lengthy writing in that fashion. But back in the day, that's how it was done. So for the next half hour, we'll be talking with Lance Morrow and getting his insights on this really unique period, I think, in American history, and especially for journalists. Lance, nice to have you with us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I get the sense that, you, like myself, you're somewhat nostalgic, and the fact that a bygone era has really cemented itself in your mind.
Oh yeah, it's well, I have mixed feelings. I must say, the computer is a great thing for writing, but my son lives down in Sydney, Australia, and works for a newspaper down there. And a couple of years ago, I walked into their newsroom and was amazed that it looked like a funeral parlor or an insurance office. There was barely a sound. There was a very subdued click of computer keyboards. And, of course, when I grew up in the business, in the latter part of the 20th century, a newspaper newsroom was an absolute bedlam, on deadline, with banging typewriters and people yelling copy and running around. Excuse me. So it's the difference between typewriters and computers was a very, very distinct dividing line. And it was not just the dividing line between the mechanics of the business and the way you put down your story, but it was the dividing line between old techniques of journalism and the way that journalism was done, and the effects have been enormous. This book is not about journalistic theory. It's mainly about the 20th century and the sort of the golden age of certain print publications, magazines and newspapers and so on, with a lot of characters from that time and a lot of stories, anecdotes, jokes and so on. But it does, in a larger sense, talk about the difference between journalism then and journalism now.
Well, as you were talking, I was thinking of I'm a classic movie fan. I was thinking of His Girl Friday. Right, with Cary Grant. And just as you were talking about that newsroom floor, perhaps 100 reporters yelling and, on the phones, but banging out stories, one key at a time. And if you were doing a daily, Lance, I got to ask you, I mean, you're talking about having to meet not only a deadline, but depending on the topic of the story, some could be very lengthy, others perhaps not as long, but still you had to bang it out key by key. It had to be accurate. I assume there were proofreaders, but I guess what I'm trying to say is it was a task. And I'm not begrudging anybody today or taking it away from people who write today, because as you said, technology has given us the computer, the laptops has made life a little bit easier. But you do have to give credit to those early days and the reporters and the people who had to really hone their skills, meet deadlines to get a top-notch story in the papers, right?
Exactly, Al. But the one thing that you what must be borne in mind about today is that the journalists have it pretty rough these days because there are fewer of them. They have to work longer hours. They're working, some of them, 24/7 on Twitter and all of that. So there's a distinct downside to the technology. Well, there are many downsides to the technology, which I can discuss. But going back to the 20th century, to the old days of former America, it was a much more primitive process, and yet it had some very distinct advantages. There was a lot more in-person interviewing, for example. Today, the overworked reporters that I'm talking about very often are just doing their reporting with a mouse, basically. I mean, they're going to different websites. There's a lot of aggregation of the news, so you've got an awful lot of recirculation of the same material and reporting off of government websites and so on. And then another point is that very often, say you're a reporter and you want to interview a politician, and the politician says, okay, we'll do it by email. And so you submit your questions to him by email, and he's got his press secretary or his legislative aide right there, and they fix up an answer. But it really affects the quality of the reporting, because being there and face-to-face is one of the fundamentals of good journalism. I'm sure you agree. And you lose a lot of that dimension these days when so much is done by computer. But when you talked about typing, I talk in the book early on about how everybody had, among journalists, had a different style of typing. Some used two fingers, for example, and they would sort of, their fingers would hover over the keyboard until they'd located the right key. And then some, and some got very, very fast at that. And some were professional type. They held their elbows close to the rib cage, you know, and there would be a very professional kind of all fingers and both thumbs would be engaged in the whole process. When I was a kid on the Washington Star, Carl Bernstein and I were good friends, and still are, actually. But Carl was a tremendously fast typist. That's how he got the job, as a dictation typist. We both started as dictation typists because it was an afternoon paper, and reporters would phone in their stories, and we would type them as they talked to us through the earphones. And Carl was just blazingly fast with all fingers and so on. So anyway, it's a funny. A typewriter was a sort of endearing instrument because it had an individuality that you just absolutely, of course, don't get with a computer. You don't find the same variety of typing styles. I always was amused by the difference in the way that reporters would attack the keyboard.
I like that term, the attacking, because you're exactly right. Even in local newspaper here, the Worcester Telegram and Gazette, I remember walking into the newsroom as a kid, and as you said, fingers blazing on those keys. You know, sometimes in a very unique rhythmic fashion. Other times, as you said, just kind of poke, bang, bang. And right. It's amazing, as I said, that they met deadlines and everything else. Not only that, though, Lance, I want to get your sense, because you worked in this environment, is the fact that while they were all pecking away, it wasn't the quietest of machines. So 20, 30, 40, maybe even 50 reporters in one room, perhaps side by side, not necessarily, nobody had a private, maybe unless you were at the upper end of the echelon, but, you know, you all shared shoulder to shoulder. It must have been distracting as all hell. I mean, I know when I have my PC, if someone just rings my cell phone or just sends a text, it's like, damn, leave me alone. You know?
I'll tell you, it's great training for working in, excuse me, I'm sorry, for working in chaos. I, to this day, I still am very good working in noisy environments. I there was a period when I was working for Time Magazine a long time ago, when I was working on a tough story, when I would get on the New York City subway and I would ride back and forth for an hour or two, writing, not on a typewriter, I'd be using a notebook, but for some weird reason, I found it easier to concentrate in the noise of a subway and the noise and the bustle of a subway than I did up in the Time offices. And so it is. It was training in for somehow closing out on the sort of insulating your, or you'd be sitting there in this noise, this turmoil of people shouting, you know, copy and all that stuff. But you learned how to focus. Another interesting skill that one learned was how to dictate a story over the phone. I mean, you'd be standing, this was pay phones. This is another obsolete technology. you know, you'd have to have a pocket full of dimes or, yeah dimes.
Right.
It was. And you'd be there. You'd have to find a public phone. So you were out covering some story or other, some murder or fire. And you'd have to find a public phone, and then you'd have to, you know, pick it up, put in a dime, and get the city desk, and then they would. There was a switchboard in the city room, and Blanche, this was at the Washington Star, would plug you in with one of those old, you know, she'd have a whole bunch of cords with
right.
plugs, and she would plug you into a rewrite. Man, or sometimes rewrite woman, and you would dictate, or to a dictationist, and you would dictate off the cuff. And so it's a very useful skill. I learned how to compose a story without the keyboard, just talking into the phone, and that again was a way of concentrating. There were little skills you learned.
Well, you just took the words out of my mouth, Lance, is the fact that there had to be you had to learn a multitude of skills, whether you came to the job with those initially, you know, by and large, you had to learn them just to be able to survive and to be able to put a story forth. I want to take a quick pause to remind listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. I'm joined by author and journalist Lance Morrow. His new book is The Noise of Typewriters, Remembering How Journalism Once Was, and we're really taking a trip down, as they say, memory lane, a bygone era, an era in which Lance, cut his teeth, for lack of a better term, in the journalism business when typewriters, as we've been talking about, learning all the skills and able to put forth a story to meet deadlines. And Lance, I know you said, and you're right. I mean, there's no question that advancements in technology has made life easier. I mean, you can put a story together, put it in a Word document, or otherwise send it off to an editor today. You don't even have to be in the office. But those skills that you talked about, being able to do that job on a subway, especially in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, crowded, noisy, craziness going on, or stopping on a street corner, as you said, pocket full of dimes. I remember those days, getting into a phone booth, hoping that somebody's not going to be banging on the glass and saying, hey, buddy, hurry up, get out of there, and relaying a story. So compare today versus back then. Would you say that journalists, and you know, you said it yourself, 24/7 today, it's not a piece of cake, but you really had to, if you didn't come to the job with a bunch of skills, you inevitably had to either learn them or you really weren't going to cut it, right?
Yeah, well, it was a good education, and it was a kind of apprenticeship, and it was a good education because of the what you learn from the city desk and from the city editor, especially. The what was tolerated and not tolerated was very different in those days. Adjectives, for example, you didn't use adjectives unless you were saying that the suspect was wearing a green shirt. You did not use your own colorful characterizations in the writing of a story. You did not use adverbs. You would be thought nuts if you started throwing in some of the stuff that appears now in the New York Times or the Washington Post or other papers where the reporter is characterizing the news that he or she is setting forth. It was really a different. I emphasize that, you know, the journalism is a lot of trouble. It's become media, and media because of social media and all of that. It's a whole different creature, and print media are dying like extinction animals, right? Local media, local papers, and so on. So this puts tremendous pressure on the reporters, as we have been saying, 24/7, and you're expected to tweet, do a lot of tweeting, which has its own dynamic of error, because tweeting is not necessarily the most responsible, accurate way of putting out information. I mean, but people with a hair trigger Twitter instinct are going to put out a lot of stuff that is ill digested or maybe just plain inaccurate.
Right.
And so it's a whole different thing. Social media, the coming of the smartphone especially, has very much changed the metaphysics of information. Not almost, the actual metaphysics of information. And so this has had enormous consequences in politics and culture and all kinds of things. My book is a kind of unusual hybrid of a personal memoir about stories of the newspapers that I worked for before I went to Time Magazine, where I stayed, God help me, for 40 years. Partly that memoir stuff, but also talking about great journalists and terrible journalists of the 20th century, and cases, specific controversial cases of journalism and how it was done. I talk about John Hersey's report on Hiroshima, which became famous, and some people regarded it as the finest piece of journalism in the 20th century, and I discuss that proposition. And then I discuss what some people regarded as the worst case of journalism in the 20th century, which was Walter Duranty reporting or not reporting on Stalin in 1932, at the time that Stalin was committing a virtual genocide in Ukraine and the Upper Caucasus, North Caucasus, by taking the food away from all of the so-called kulaks. There were 5, 6, 7, 8 million people who died because Stalin took all their food away. And Duranty, at the very same time Stalin was doing this, published a series in the New York Times, for which he was the Moscow bureau chief, praising Stalin, talking about what a great job he was doing. And it was as a result of that series that the new president, Franklin Roosevelt, recognized the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had, Stalin had very much wanted that recognition, and he got it, thanks to Durante. And Stalin and Durante both coined the expression, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. you know, and the eggs, unfortunately, were millions of Ukrainians and people in the North Caucasus.
Right.
So I talk about cases, famous cases or not so famous cases of journalism. And it's a series of essays really about how journalism was practiced in the 20th century before this rather sharp dividing line that came with the advent of computers, smartphones, a whole different way of doing business.
I think of it as, you know, having to be face to face. Not only were you a writer, you also had to be a pretty astute person in terms of measuring up that person you were interviewing, whether it be a man or a woman. Are they giving you, are they being honest with you? Is it the straight, talk? Are they not? Their mannerisms, how they move, facial gestures. See, I think that's all was a big part of it. And I think, you know, it's somewhat diluted today because, as you said, a lot of it, especially with social media, you know, people aren't even in the moment, as they say, yet putting a story forth. So there was that aspect, right?
Right, absolutely. Well, I have almost a religion of the idea of being there. In other words, being there yourself and seeing it, and is a witness. I mean, a journalist is supposed to be a witness of some kind. And I say early on in the book that while journalism in those days was kind of seedy and you know, it had that aspect, the kind of front page or His Girl Friday kind of seedy life and the scruffy kind of work, nevertheless, it really is a sacred business in that you're a witness. And if journalism doesn't get it right and tell us the truth, then who will? I mean, is it somebody's press secretary or who? So what you say is absolutely right, that being there, talking to the person and seeing it and feeling it, and then, of course, you have the... I mean, it's never easy because... how do you process your own value judgments while preserving your objectivity, or what Carl Bernstein calls the best available version of the truth? I mean, one of the most difficult and fascinating and painful stories that I worked for was during the first Intifada in 1988, 89, 90, 91 in Israel and Palestine. And I did two cover stories for Time magazine. One was on Israel on its 40th anniversary, and the other was on the situation of the Palestinians and their history as they saw it and so on. And so I went to Israel and talked, you know, for days, and I had the luxury of a lot of time, and I talked day after day to Israelis and survivors of the Holocaust and so on, and I absorbed all of their stories, many of their stories, that is, and understood the point of view of that side. And then I would go over to the Palestinians, go to Nablus and down to Gaza and the West Bank and Khan Yunis and all over the place. And I would talk day after day to Palestinians about their stories and absorb their version, which of course was the diametrically opposed to the other. And so how do you tell those stories? How do you how does a journalist deal with that, except to tell their stories, of course. I mean, you just tell them each side and tell their stories. But is that good enough just to tell, to repeat the stories? And how do you, what about making value judgments and what kind of value judgments and so on? So it's not an easy business in a situation like that. In narrative lines, I talk a lot about the narrative line that you take and the temptations of the narrative line, because everybody who tells a story knows that you're tempted constantly to make it a better story, a more vivid story, a funnier story, a more dramatic story, whatever. And so you, in order to make it, even with the best will in the world, in order to make it a better story, there's always the temptation to embellish and to select the right details and so on. And so this is a tremendous problem, the conflict between straight journalism, you know, kind of cop journalism, police journalism, mind you, you know, who was the victim, a man or a woman, what was the caliber of the pistol and so on. The conflict between that and evaluation, drama, judgment. How do you separate your own feelings from? How do you sort out your feelings from? And so it's always, this is a problem that continues in spades now in the 21st century. But I remember in the late 30s, when Edward R. Murrow was running the CBS London Bureau, and it was maybe the mid-30s, maybe 36, 37, and he got a memo from the New York office of CBS saying, listen, you're not being fair to Hitler. You're not giving Hitler's side of the story. And you know, so what do you do with that?
Yeah,
How do you handle that kind of thing?
It's cerebral, for lack of a better term. Not only the skill of putting the story together, but as you said, the inner conflict, the thoughts that go through, especially in that era, the journalist's mind, and then the public at large, the criticisms or the accolades, whatever it may be. We've got like a minute left, so let me ask you real quick, Lance. In completing the book, and you've already mentioned some of the, you know, some of the stellar names, the Carl Bernsteins of the world and the Walter Winchells. But who's been your hero?
That's hard. A figure who runs through the book prominently is an unlikely person. That's Henry Luce, who was the founder of Time magazine and Time, Inc. He and his partner, Britton Haddon, started it, and then Britton Haddon died but in 29. But I wouldn't say that Luce was my hero, but he's the most consequential journalist of the 20th century, and then I go on to try to prove that. But not exactly a hero. But
someone that you respect.
A great deal of respect, and respect that was denied him in much of his life. He wasn't appreciated, I believe, at his true value. And so the book got a lot about him and about what he did and the American context in which he did it.
Right.
I have a lot of heroes.
Yeah,
he was one.
And I think that people, when they buy the book, Lance's book, is the Noise of Typewriters, will find their own hero within the pages of the book. Real quick, Lance, because we only got a few moments left, if people want to reach you directly, just reach, find out more information about you, how might they do that?
Well, I think the easiest way is, I'm terrible at websites, so if they just go to Google, there's a lot of stuff on in Wikipedia and stuff like that. So Google can give them all my articles.
Yeah. Great. Sounds good. It's Lance Morrow has been my guest. He's the author of the new book, The Noise of Typewriters, Remembering How Journalism Once Was, a bygone era, I should say. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios of WICN, 508-752-0700. For the public eye, this is Al Bowman.